they're weirdest things in the world. I'm so used to wearing those other things, and I got these in here, and it feels truly. I'm still not really clear how this works with this, but it seems to. If Chris is technically challenged, I'm technically times 10 challenged, and so it's it's crazy. I like Chris. Have had an unbelievable amount of joy in flipping through the pages of this thing, and it's amazing how many of you I know and have met, and what an absolute treat. I talked to Dave just a little while ago on the telephone, and that guy, practicing total dishonesty, didn't say one word about being on this thing tonight. So I was really surprised when he showed up like that. I love that guy. This is pretty special. Ali, thank you for you and your cohorts that put this thing together. I remember years ago making a weird joke about somebody that was chairing a conference. And I remember him, it was kind of disparaging what I said. And I remember he looked at me and he said, "Myers, one of these days you're going to be in my shoes and you're going to know what an idiot you really are." And it wasn't 2 years later that I got to chair a big men's conference out in West Texas. And I don't think I've ever worked so hard in my whole life trying to get stuff together and deal with it. And when the conference was done and everybody was packed and gone, I remember walking around that facility and crying like a little bitty kid. I mean, it was just like, oh my gosh, it's truly an amazing way to serve. And so I'm truly grateful. When they canceled the one in July, I was kind of heartbroken. And so it's kind of cool that we get to do this. So some of you I haven't met. For those that I haven't had the pleasure to meet, my name is Myers Raymer. I'm a very grateful recovered alcoholic from up by Dallas, Texas. I'm a little north of Dallas. And Chris, where he is right now, is 300 miles south and west of where I was raised and where I took my first drink too. And so it I always enjoy hearing Chris. Chris is still my favorite speaker. I love hearing him, love talking to him. You'd think I'd get tired of it by now. We've done hundreds of workshops together over the years, and he I still really enjoy it. It's always good. Chris sobered up. I'm sure he'll tell you. Chris sobered up 2 months before I did. I took my last drink January 15th of 88. And the cool part about it is, really, is that I've got one sobriety date, January 15th of 88. Chris had a whole shoebox full of desire chips by the time I got sober. And it was, but interestingly enough, Chris saved my life. He took me to that first AA meeting. I mean, I don't think I would have ever gone by myself. He took me to that first one. And then 7 years later, when I kind of came apart in AA, he took me to my, introduced me to a guy that would change a whole lot about who I am and what I've become. And I want to say real quick, there's another reason why I really, really love doing this. As I've gotten older, I don't like one night talks. Like if I'm just going to do one talk, I'll do them obviously. But what I love to do is when we get a chance to do this, and then we get a chance to do some workshop stuff and talk about the things that are near and dear, understanding the basic text, sponsorship, this kind of stuff. But I also have found out a long time ago that there are oftentimes I'll say something, and then somebody will misunderstand what I said, or they don't understand it from the same perspective that I'm trying to relay it. And there's always some friction. And I remember years and years ago, I got finished doing a talk, and this lady walked up to the podium afterwards, and she just made a beeline to me. And when she got up to me, she reached out and grabbed my tie and jerked me off the podium. I mean, it was like, and I'm just like going, "Oh, whoa, 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 what's going on?" And she said, "I can't believe you said that." And I said, "Said what?" And she said, and then she said something. And I looked at her and I said, I didn't say that. And the guy standing next to her, who was my host, went, Mary, he didn't say that. And she goes, oh, and let go of my tie and just walked off. And I thought, oh, golly, what? Oh, my gosh. I called Chris that night and I said, all right, I'm done. I'm not going to do this anymore. It's gotten dangerous. And but it didn't take long to get back in the saddle. What a treat. It's funny, growing up with Chris, we kind of went through the same sort of stuff. I think I need to say for the taping record that I didn't throw the rock that hit Chris. I was there, but I didn't throw the rock. So it was just stupid. Bunch of kids throwing rocks at each other, and you know what happened. So I was always concerned whether Chris was ever going to get sober. I like Chris in the same respect. We were both functioning alcoholics. We did a lot of the same kind of stuff. And it's an amazing thing. You can, for a lot of us, we drank normally. I mean, I could drink a 12-pack of beer and a half a bottle of vodka, and you'd really never know I had anything to drink. That's just the way it was. Until it wasn't. Until it got to a place to where it began to change. We don't know where we are on that continuum from that line that says, from right over here is my very first drink, and over here I'm brain dead in a hospital ward with somebody taking care of me until I die. We don't know where we are on that line. And so some little rascals, I sponsor a whole bunch of little guys right now that drank for a year and they were done. I mean, like amazing done. And so you just don't know how it's going to affect you. I, like Chris, also have lots of doubts about the genetic end of this thing. Chris, and we'll talk about this some in the morning. It's an interesting thing. You don't drink yourself into alcoholism. The genetic predisposition is either there or it's not there. We have a lot of folks out there, sort of authority guys, who seem to think that it's all a causal kind of a thing, that, you know, if you want to quit, just quit. You know, just, it's the old pull yourself up by the bootstrap stuff. And so it got to a place where I was eventually trying to do that. And I would always just tell myself, I just changed my mind. One of the last experiments I did with this was to, I was a member of a really fine church in Houston. And I remember a bunch of folks praying with me one Sunday, and I'm not going to do this anymore. And then it wasn't 3 hours later, I was sitting at my house with a 12-pack of beer sitting on the floor in front of me, watching the Houston Oilers get their butts kicked again. You can tell how long ago that was. But it was like, how did I go from a church where I'm going to be okay to my house 3 hours later, and I'm in trouble again? And my head, because it is completely insane around this, we kept telling myself, it's okay, you're gonna be okay, you just changed your mind, it's not that big a deal. Next time you're not gonna make the same mistakes, you're gonna make better decisions, you're gonna get a girlfriend eventually, I always had a solution, and most of you guys are in that same kind of situation. And so Chris did work at the bindery with Londa and I, and we had, it was a lot of fun. Chris got to be my best drinking buddy. He would later become my dope dealer, if we're going to talk about a little bit of outside issue, not a lot, but I mean, he was, we were kind of joined, and it was a weird deal when he sobered up. I couldn't believe it. In the last couple of months, it was just a bad combination for me, that I go from being able to drink and not show it to, I drink two beers and I couldn't keep from slurring my words, walking into walls, it affects me differently, and I know I'm in trouble. I know that I'm going to have to do something. And so my wife by now is completely exhausted with my behavior. And she's now, Myers, why don't you sleep in that little bitty bed down at the end of that hall, and I'll sleep in the bigger bed down at the end of this hall, and we'll just kind of try to cohabitate. We had a little girl at the time, a little daughter, and it's just kind of goofy. I think most of y'all can understand that kind of thing. It's just like the stuff starts piling up and you begin to think, okay, now I'm running out of excuses for the things that are going on. I remember, Chris, I want to tell this little piece because it was really pivotal for me. I remember we had a big dinner over. Chris and I have been, you know, pit hounds for forever. We love barbecuing and smoking stuff. And so we were over at the house and I had been working on a little lawn tractor thing outside, and I kept dropping screws in the grass, and I've been drinking beer all day. 40 pounds heavier than I am now. And it was just, it's mostly gut, big fat face and all red faced. And I keep dropping screws and I'm getting angry. And Chris is sitting there on a stump drinking iced tea, watching me. He's been sober for 2 months. I just looked at him. I'm trying to turn this tractor over with my bare hands because I'm so angry. And I remember Chris looking at me, and he stood up and he said, you know, it doesn't have to be this way. And he turned around and he walked in the house. And I remember looking at him as he walked away, and I went, I don't know what to do. And I just, later that night, I remember standing out by my Land Cruiser. Everybody had left, and I'm sitting out there by the Land Cruiser, and I got a bottle of vodka and a hot beer that I got out rolling around in the seat of the truck. And I'm just sitting out there watching the moon, and I realized it hit me like a ton of bricks. This is as good as it's ever going to get. And from here, it will end. And it was just this kind of horrible sinking feeling that told me that there was no more joking. There was no more deflecting. There was no more rationalization. I had to do something. And so the next day at work, I asked Chris if he would take me to an AA meeting. And he grinned and he said, sure. And he did. And so listen, guys, I'm one of these guys that I'm one of these guys that fell in love with AA. I truly, from the moment I went in there, the nicest people I've ever met, the smoke-filled room, I got sober. And I one day at a time, I managed to go to enough meetings. I didn't work the steps. I want to be as transparent with you as I can be. I didn't work the steps, and I didn't have a sponsor. Later, I got a sponsor in name only because he drove the prettiest black Mercedes I'd ever seen, and he wore a nice suit of clothes. And I figured, since I'm a business guy and he's a business guy, we'll be able to swap business stuff. Alcoholism and trying to stay sober never even entered the picture. And as a consequence, I'm sort of the poster boy of, yes, you can stay sober one day at a time, which the book never says, but you can do that. Our little mantras keep saying that. Just keep coming back. Just keep coming back. And I did. The problem with this stuff, guys, and this is probably the most important part of the stuff that I want to talk about tonight, was that it's possible that you can go to a whole bunch of meetings and you can find yourself sliding sideways. Some of you have experienced this nightmare, and it's truly troublesome to be 100% convinced that you're doing everything that you're supposed to do in recovery, which is show up and be in a meeting, and then find yourself in a situation where slowly but surely, day by day, you begin to get depressed, you begin to get anxious, you begin to get irritated with everybody. Long about 3 years sober, the fun part of it went away, and I'm starting to be a bit of a jerk. If you were to ask Londa, my wife, she would say, no, you were a real jerk. It was ridiculous. And so 4 years into the deal, guys, it's manifesting in weird ways. Later, somebody would say, Myers, didn't you see that you were getting sick again? And I went, all I saw was that I was falling apart, but I didn't understand why. And they said, you couldn't tell that it was untreated alcoholism. I said, well, how would I know that? I didn't even know what alcoholism was. I didn't even understand the disease, so I didn't know. And so all I know is that I'm sober one day at a time, and I'm coming home every evening, and I'm eating a half a gallon of Blue Bell ice cream, which is nectar from God as far as I'm concerned. If they don't have it in Toronto, we need to make sure y'all get some pronto. It's amazing. I've gained 25 pounds. I hate my employees at work. I'm not digging my family. My kids are driving me crazy. My wife is driving me crazy. It's just, she's now asking me to live in opposite ends of the house again because she doesn't really want to be with me, and I don't blame her. I mean, it's I'm not a very lovable guy. Guys, I'm spending money. I don't know. Some of y'all can relate. How many of you guys ever bought things you didn't need? I mean, I'm buying clothes I don't wear. I'm buying music I don't listen to. I'm buying tools I didn't even know what they were. I mean, I remember my wife one time saying, "Myers, what is that?" And I went, "I don't know, but look how cool it is. Look, I mean, it's just the coolest." I said, she said, "I know, but it costs $160. Well, I've got an expense account with work, so I mean, I can buy all these tools because I might need them. And that's what I told her. I said, this may come in handy like that. It's just this. Oh God, y'all! I was literally nutting in a squirrel turd. And by this time, I'm 5 years sober. I bought an airplane. I wanted to learn to fly, and so I bought this airplane and finished up taking lessons. I could never stay sober long enough to take a check ride. So I get sober, take the check ride, and then I bought this airplane. And then a little bit later, I decided I needed another one, so I bought another airplane. And then a little bit later, I know it's going to sound weird like this, I needed an aviation project. So I bought a project airplane, which demands another half of a hangar and insurance and the rest of this kind of stuff. Guys, it was just like, guys, we can't afford one airplane. But now I own three. And it just, my wife is sitting there. If she had a beard, she'd have been scratching it. She's just sitting there looking at me going, what is going on? Long about 6 years sober, quote unquote, the depression came back in spades. I'm getting up every day with suicidal thoughts that I'd never had before. Guys, in all those years in booze and dope land, I never ever thought about killing myself. And here I am 6 years sober, and it's a reoccurring thought. The depression is killing me. I can't get out of bed. I'm struggling, trying to work. I just don't know what I'm going to do. I'm sharing this in meetings. I'm talking about this stuff in meetings, and people are saying the same thing. They're just going, "Well, Myers, let me, you know, every meeting you share the same thing." And I say, "Well, I know, but I realize that I'm going to drink if I don't do something. I don't know what to do." And I remember this guy one night, nicest guy in the world. He wasn't a jerk. He said, "Myers, let me ask you a question, buddy. Did you drink this morning when you got up?" And I went, "No, sir." And he said, "Well, then you're a winner." And I went, "Okay." And after the meeting, I remember walking outside, and my old Land Cruiser was parked out on the street. And I remember sliding in that Land Cruiser, and I shut the door, and I put my head down on the steering wheel, and I cried like a little kid. I just wept and wept. Guys, I don't want to drink. I don't want to go back to a dope house. I don't want to do any of that stuff. What I really want to do is just live my life happy and not disappoint my family, and do a good job at work, and just live my life. And I don't know what's going on. Chris, the evil twin, because he left and now moved to the hill country in central Texas, and he'd gotten married, and he had a sponsor that was a big book guy. I wasn't really clear what that was, but he seemed happy every time I talked to him. And he'd been trying for literally years to get me to go do something like work the steps. Getting ready. And so I called him one night and I said, "Hey, there's a really good chance that I'm going to drink." And he said, "I've been telling you that for 3 years." And I said, I need to do something. And he said, "Did you ever call Clifford?" And he had given me the name of this old guy in Dallas for years before. And I said, no, I hadn't called him. And he said, "I don't understand why." And I said, "Okay, I will." A couple of days later, he called me and he said, "What did Clifford say?" And I said, "Well, I didn't call him yet." And I remember Chris just hanging up the phone. I mean, he didn't slam it down like he was mad, but I called him back and I said, "Did you hang up on me?" And he said, "Yeah, I did. I don't know what else to say, Myers. I said, I can't make you do this." And I went, "Okay, all right." So I went and saw this guy, and I want to cut through this because I've got a bunch of other stuff that I want to talk about. But Clifford was real direct with me. It took him about 5 minutes to cut to the chase, he started asking me a bunch of questions about AA that I didn't know. He asked me about the steps, which I didn't understand. He asked me all some stuff, and I'm trying to be funny and deflect them and this kind of stuff. And I remember that very first meeting, his wife was sitting in that meeting with us. She was over there knitting or drawing or something. I don't remember what she was doing, but I remember at one point she got up and she walked out of the room. And a year or so later, after I had gotten really emotionally sober, I remember her walking up to me after a meeting, and she said, "That was the single most uncomfortable conversation I'd ever heard between two men. Clifford was trying to help you, and all you wanted to do is make jokes, and it got really uncomfortable." And I said, I know, I see it now. I totally get it now." But what Clifford would later tell me, he said, "Myers, teaching you the steps will be the easiest thing that we do. Seriously. I mean, teaching you to what you need to do to have this amazing experience with the work is going to be pretty easy to do. Getting you to unlearn all this old stuff that you brought in here for 7 years is going to be a little more difficult." And it was. I had a whole head full of misinformation. You know, there was a song in an old Crosby, Stills, and Nash Young song that said, "Confusion has its cost." And that was my status quo as a guy in the rooms. I'm 3 weeks shy of 7 years sober, and I'm confused about everything. I don't understand how any of this stuff works. I can't explain what alcoholism is. I've never sponsored anybody. Fast forward a little bit. It took about 3 weeks, three whole weeks to work the steps with him. We got through the stuff, and I had this fairly amazing transformation with this. And then I had to make a decision whether I was going to stay in that group or whether I was going to go back to my original home group, which was what my original intent was. But I never went back. And I've been a member of Primary Purpose Group Dallas for 25 years now, I guess. And it's just we have three book studies a week, a step study on Saturday night, and two book studies on Tuesday and Thursday. And we're Zooming those now. And it's just a fun place to go and study the text. And I just stayed. It was sort of an amazing deal. Let me fill in one little more part of this before I move on. I was willing. There's a piece of me very prideful that was excited about the fact that I now knew something about the Big Book. I could spout a little page number every once in a while, and I could talk about who that guy was and who that guy was, but I still wasn't doing some key things. My workaround, step 11 was non-existent, and I was doing no disciplines, the 12-step stuff. I wasn't sponsoring anybody at all. I'm almost 9 years sober at that time, and I'd never sponsored anybody. And Clifford snagged me one night, and he said, I asked him, I said, "I still feel like I'm somehow different than the rest of you guys." And he said, "Myers, you are. I mean, you're like, you are different, but you're not doing what we do." And I said, "Can you tell me what I need to do?" And I remember it like it was yesterday. I remember he took his glasses off, and he kind of goes, and he looked at the ceiling, and he said, "Myers, I'm going to tell you one more time what to do, and then either do it or go away." And I'm thinking, okay, he just means go away on Thursday to the Thursday night meeting. And then I went, wait a minute, maybe he means go away, go away. I was like all eyes, I'm going four of them, and I'm looking at him going, tell me what I need to do. And he said, "You need to get off your skinny ass and get busy doing something for somebody else. Because like Chris, it's like you're a taker." Guys, listen, every one of us, I don't care who you are, when you're new and you come into the rooms like this, we're all takers. That's what we do. That's what the program is there for, is to feed us. But at some point in time, you need to quit standing there waiting to be fed, and you need to go feed. You need to be there to try to help somebody else. And that's what was going on. That was the part that was missing. And so I want to tell you a little piece of this. I left on my own devices. I wasn't going to do any 12-step work because I was 100% convinced that I'm too stupid to do it. I'm never going to be sharp enough. I'm never going to be commanding enough as a 12-stepper to make any difference in anybody's life. And so I'm just not going to do it. And it's a funny thing. It's in the nature of our fellowship. If you stay long enough, if you get some years behind you, you become sort of iconic in your AA group. And most people won't question whether you're sponsoring people or whether you're not sponsoring people. And that's unfortunate because here I am, an old guy or an older guy, been around the rooms and I've never been involved with anybody. I'm just terrified of it. It's hard for me to explain how nervous the idea of sponsorship made me because I couldn't get really clear around it. We'll talk about that some tomorrow. It's just one of my very favorite things to talk about. Clifford said, tomorrow, I want you to go to Salvation Army. And I said, I'm going to go to the Salvation Army tomorrow. Clifford, I always go to the Salvation Army. And he said, no, I know you go to the Salvation Army. You drive over there with me and you put books on chairs and you sit in the back of the room and you ignore what's going on. And after the meeting, you pick the books up and you drive home with me, but you don't really do anything. And we've been doing this for a year or so now and you need to really get busy. And I said, okay, I will. I promise you I'll do it. Next day, I end up over at Salvation Army, and I walk in, and I'm looking around, and I don't see Clifford's car, and I don't see Phil's car, and I don't see, I mean, none of the regular guys are there, and I'm thinking, I'll just go on in. And so I walked on in and cleared their security. Now, the Salvation Army in Dallas is enormous. It's huge. There's 160 guys in that room, and I'm still looking for them, and I'm sweating BBs. Now, nobody showed up. So I'm standing there with a big book and a perfect knowledge of where we were last week when we were there. I know where we were. But the thought of me conducting that meeting was terrifying. Guys, I'm sweating my shirt through. I'm pacing the floor back and forth like this. I'm trying to avoid people's eyes. I'm thinking any minute they're going to walk in and they're going to save me and it's going to be okay. And those bastards, they never showed up. I laugh every time I think about it like that. They say that it was never planned that way. I totally disagree and believe that it was planned. They just got me going. And so when it's time to start, I got up there, did a share. It got easier. It got more comfortable. And as I got in there, I got kind of having fun and we were laughing back and forth some like this, and I'm thinking toward the end of it, I'm thinking, I'll never have to do this again. I'm gonna leave here tonight and I'm gonna milk this for 15 years. I'm gonna milk this experience and I'm gonna go, yep, I did that talk out there at that Sally. Like, that's what I'm gonna do. I had no intention of doing it again. I survived and that's all I wanted to do. Well, I get done. We do the Lord's Prayer, which is sort of amazing with 160 guys in that room doing the Lord's Prayer. It was like being in some kind of cathedral in Europe. It was just amazing. And we get done. And this guy said, hey, before you leave, is there any chance you could come back over here tomorrow night? Guys, and I'm just, there's a piece of me that went, oh, if I had just walked a little faster, I could have got out the door and they wouldn't have said anything. But then there was another part that went, this guy asked me to come back. I mean, wow. And so I get up the next morning feeling as the book somewhat rearranged. I couldn't explain it. I thought about it a lot, but I couldn't explain it. I get up. I go to work. My wife knows I'm distracted. She's also my business partner. She's the smart one that holds all of it together. And so she's there and she's going, what's wrong? You seem really distracted. And I said, I'm going to go back over to the Salvation Army tonight. And she said, what time? And I said, 8 o'clock. And she said, okay, it's 11 o'clock in the morning. Get in the game. And I went, yes, ma'am. I'm right on it. And 1 o'clock I left. I couldn't concentrate. I just went home, figured out what ensemble I was going to wear. What, you know, does that tie go with that? I mean, I'm just like, I don't know. It's just the weirdest deal. And I got over there at 6 o'clock in the afternoon. And it's hot and all the crazy people walking up and down the street in front of the Salvation Army over on Harry Hines. And I just, I'm sitting there waiting as quick as they'll let me in. I went in, cleared security and then walked up front and did my deal. Guys, I got to tell you, I felt like Y'all remember the old TV shows that had Jimmy Swaggart on there, and he'd always be holding his big book up like this, and he'd be sweating and all lathered up? That's what I felt like. We were studying the text, but I mean, I felt transformed up there because I was the way that these guys were responding to me, and it was sort of a crazy deal. And I wanted to tell you that when I got there, all of these guys are standing on the other end of the room. It's like in a gymnasium kind of a setting, and they're all standing on the other end. And when I walked in, they all started walking towards me really fast and kind of scary. And so they got up about 25 feet from me, and everybody stopped except this one guy. He's the biggest guy I ever saw in my whole life. His arms were as big around as my legs are. I mean, it was just like, he's huge. And he walked right up to me, and he grabbed me, and he just kind of picked me up. And I'll never forget, he picked me up like I weighed nothing. Like, I mean, my feet are not touching the ground. I'm like a little ball, just kind of hanging there like this. And he picked me up, and he's kind of holding me. And I'm thinking, this guy's going to squash me. He's squashing me. And then I'm thinking, wait a minute. If he was going to squash me, he already would. He's just holding me. And I remember just kind of relaxing, and I just put my head around on his shirt like this, and it's such a weird feeling like this. And he said, "Myers, we've been looking forward to you coming back all day long." And I went, "Me too." And he set me down, and I tell you, those guys taught me more about love and about just the power of doing things because we're supposed to do them and not expecting any kind of different outcome or this sort of thing. It was just one of those kind of things where I was just sort of transformed. I did my talk, did my little Jimmy Swaggart meal, got all sweaty. And afterwards there were five guys that asked me to sponsor them. And I went from 0 to 150 miles an hour in one talk. And it was the most transformative thing that had ever happened to me. I sit in my car driving back home. I'm thinking, I've never been happier. I've never been scareder, because I don't even know how to sponsor one guy, much less five guys. And I don't know what to do. And I called Clifford, and Clifford said, "It's not your job to worry. It's your job just to show up. It'll work out." And it did. I had more fun with those guys. On the wall of my bindery down in Central Texas like this, I've got a little plaque that those men gave me after I'd been there for a while. They gave me a little plaque that said, "Myers, Sponsor of the Year." And it was just this little gold plaque like this, and I would put it on my wall. And I don't know, if that building burnt down, I'm not sure that there's anything in there that I wouldn't leave except for that plaque. It was just the coolest little Sponsor of the Year. Holy cow. It was just sort of a crazy deal. One of the things real quick is one of the things about, and I think there are a lot of y'all that can relate to what I'm talking about. If you spent any time in AA not doing the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and then you start doing the program, it's like a night and day sort of a situation. And you kind of stop quoting the aphorisms off the wall. You know, the think, and the rest of it. You just kind of stop doing that, and you start kind of focusing on what Bill talks about. That's the reason why I love the idea of step studies and book studies like this, because it helps us to understand in the bigger picture. One of the coolest things that I learned in these book studies was how to qualify somebody, the stuff that we'll talk about in the morning, how to help people see their real truth around their disease. One of the coolest things about the big book was that it was full of promises, for sure. It was also full of directions. This is a book of suggestions. You can take what you want and leave the rest. We used to hear that stuff all the time. The reality of it is that Bill and them were clearer with that. We didn't get it really confusing until much later, by the 70s and 80s and 90s. Things did get really, the literature began to change a lot. It was just like that Chris, one of Chris's favorite books is Living Sober. He loves that book. Matter of fact, he probably would love to have one from you. It's just like he loves it. He's dying right now. I can't see him on my screen, but he's probably crapping for me saying that like that. One of these days, I'm not going to – all right, I'll rag on it a little bit. I'm just going to say one of the things that I want you to do sometime when you don't have anything else to do is drag that book out. It was published after Bill Wilson died. drag that book out and compare it with what you read in the basic text. We counted 29 conflicts where the big book says do this, and Living Sober said do this, and it's they're complete contradictions. And then we wonder why our newcomers and people coming in. I've had hundreds of people sitting in meetings that were sharing, going, guys, if y'all find that big book too complicated like that, just get you this Living Sober book and just do what it says and you'll be okay. I'm not saying that the book doesn't have some suggestions that might be helpful, but the confusion that it sets up will kind of blow you away. In 1966, Bill Wilson had written this letter, and this was a little excerpt from it. I'm not going to read it all. I just want to read one little paragraph in there that talks about it. In the third paragraph down on this thing, it's called Whose Responsibility. It said, this is why sobriety, freedom from alcohol, through the teaching and practice of AA's 12 steps, is the sole purpose of the group. If we don't stick to this cardinal principle, we shall almost certainly collapse. And if we collapse, we cannot help anyone. I want to read the first line of that again. This is why sobriety, freedom from alcohol through the teaching and practice of AA's 12 steps, is the sole purpose of the group. And the little piece that Chris read earlier, like that, our chief responsibility to the newcomer is an adequate presentation of the program. Guys, I'm 7 years sober, and I'm still questioning whether or not I'm an alcoholic or not. I still have this lurking notion up in my head that maybe I've made a mistake here, like this, which is crazy, like that. Look at how many times Bill Wilson repeats the same theme over and over and over. Big ticket items: your relationship with your Creator, how we find the power, and look at how many times he repeats that same stuff over and over. The idea. In four different places that I know, and somebody said the other day that there was a fifth one, but I didn't catch where it was. But for four places that I know, go back. If you want something fun to do sometime, go back in the book and look at Fred's story and Jim's story in the front of the book. There is a solution in More About Alcoholism. In More About Alcoholism, they'll do Jim's story and Fred's story. And both of these stories, they end up with two little knuckleheads, Jim and Fred, who tell different stories like this. And both of those stories, those men get sober and then step in the middle of it again and get loaded. And then when they come back, they call AA back. AA comes back and sees them like this. And then in both of them, the same example is given. And it says, we told them what we knew about alcoholism. Now, so hear me out. They didn't say, when we got back in front of Jim, we told him our story again. Guys, I'm not making light of your story. I love the fact that you have a story. If you don't have one, make one up. I mean, it's, you got to have a story. You need to be able to relate like that. I totally get that. But after a while, how many of you guys have heard somebody share a story so many times that you wanted to punch them in the nuts or the neck? How about I say that? In the neck. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, come on. There is more to that. Bill Wilson didn't say it. He didn't say it. Ebby and Bill related. Ebby had a story that he took to Bill, and Bill said, hey, this is really cool. I love that. This is going to be cool. And they could relate. That's necessary. But after we've related, the newcomer that comes in, my buddy Danny that's in there from Ottawa, I've got him on my screen. Danny's brand new. He's probably got 40 years, but he comes in, he's new in my head, and he comes in and he's wanting to know what's going on. He wants to listen to somebody's story, and he hears the story, and maybe he can relate, maybe he can't relate, but at some point in time, there's a connection there. But at some point in time, quicker than we think, Danny's going to be going, hey, what is alcoholism, and how do I stay sober, and whatever. So it's like all of a sudden I'm shocked that Danny doesn't want to know about my relationship with my mother-in-law. He wants to know, wait a minute, well, dude, all I want to know is, when I get up in the morning, can I stay sober, or am I going to stay obsessive about all of this for the rest of my life? That's what he really wants to know. People, I'm like Chris in this thing. Chris always says, we're lockstep on this thing. People would say, Myers, if people hang around long enough, they'll hear what they need to hear. I understand the sentiment. I do. I'm not trying to offend anybody. I understand the sentiment. The problem with this thing is that sometimes you don't, because of the stuff that Chris was talking about. Sometimes we find ourselves in a situation where we begin to build a case against AA. And I'll listen to somebody talking about being in the sent to the penitentiary or eating out of dumpsters or wrecking a car or whatever. You see, that's the situation. But what if I can't relate to that? If I can't relate to that, I'll start building up this story against it. And I went, man, maybe I'm not. And then eventually I don't show up. And then the old timers in the room go, well, booze will drive them back in. Well, I can't make that line up with my experience. My experience has been is that sometimes we do come back, but sometimes we don't. Sometimes we go out and die. And that's the tragic part of this thing. Mitchell Kay, one of my buddies that's on here tonight, that wrote that book about Clarence Snyder, Arch in there was one of my favorite all-time AA stories in that book. And they relate this story of how important it was that we got busy and tried to explain what the solution was based on the basic text. It wasn't all just about an experience. It was about what did the book talk about. At the beginning of these steps, we slide into it at the first part of this in step one, and then quickly we get sort of bitch slapped by this lack of power. That was our dilemma. And the rest of the steps, we quickly find out, if we're serious about studying, is that every other piece of this program is about how to find the power. How do we find the power that puts us in a position that we could be transformed by a program? It's like y'all ever think about how much courage it takes to do what it is that we're doing? It's how much I'm going to take Danny, who's brand new, and he's going to walk into this room, and I'm going to ask Danny to set down the only solution that he's known as an adult, which is booze and stuff like that. I'm going to ask him to walk away from that and move towards something that he doesn't understand at all, which is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It takes real courage to do that. It truly does. And so, guys, we've never, ever, in all the years that we've had this fellowship at our disposal, we've never, ever had a problem getting people to come to AA. People will come. That's never been our problem. We have a huge problem, statistically, getting them to stay. Depending on where you are geographically, some areas are really strong and vibrant. If you sobered up in an area like that, God love you. I'm so delighted that you did. But guys, in my travels around the world, I am blown away by areas that I've been to where I'm just caught completely off guard by how little actual program is being talked about in the meetings. And people are confused and people are kind of, you know, trying to hang on to the fellowship part of it. I'm loving me some fellowship. I'm totally digging the fellowship part of this family thing. Guys, I'm telling you, if love and fellowship was all I needed to get sober and stay sober, my mama would have got me sober. Londa, my wife of almost 40 years now, would have got me sober. But it wasn't going to work. It was going to take more than that. If I'm going to stand in the sunlight of the Spirit, I'm going to have to clear away some stuff. I'm going to have to do some things. And almost all of them make me feel uncomfortable. Almost all of them. And this is the reason why the clarity that I found as I began to read the text, it was the most freeing thing that happened to me, because all of a sudden I didn't have to be Myers trying to be hip, slick, and cool and say cool things. I didn't have to be that man anymore. What I could be is Myers that understands the basic text and understands that there is a solution there that's really, really clear if you just simply do the work. 100% of the time, not sometimes, 100% of the time, if you do the work, you'll have the experience. On the bottom of a newsletter, I think it was an Akron, somebody had taken a screenshot of it and sent it to me one time, and it said, "We're the only group of people on God's green earth that takes what works and then stops doing it." And I had to laugh about it like that, because really and truly, like that, it's the absolute truth. How many of us know and have experienced what it's like to be sober one day at a time. And then all of a sudden find yourself drifting sideways and you can't really figure out a way to put the brakes on it. All of a sudden you're an irritant to people around you. You're having, this idea of restless, irritable, and discontent creeps back into the picture. And now you're just like this walking time bomb with a bunch of big red buttons on you. And you're just walking around waiting for somebody to reach out and push the button. And so what the program will do is help us get rid of the buttons so that we can be free of that complex part of the puzzle. Don Pritz, one of my favorite all-time guys like that. He was kind of iconic in my Joe McQuaney of Joe and Charlie was in my sponsorship lineage. But after I got sober and spent some time over there, I kind of fell in love with Clint Hodges and Kip Collins and some of those cats from California and Don Pritz. But in one of these old talks that Don did, Gary Brown was another one. Butch, my little buddy up in Toronto, I'm telling you, if Butch is on here tonight, he may not be. But I got to tell you, of all of the people I've met in AA, Butch may be the kindest guy that I have met. I am always blown away by how kind that guy is. So I got to stop. I go back to Don Pritz. Don Pritz goes in this talk that he did, he said, I'm a little caught off guard by how over the years we've moved away from conversation about recovery and settled for sobriety. And I remember when I first heard it, I didn't quite get it. And then later I rethought it and I went, golly, I totally get it. Guys, if your goal is to stay sober one day at a time, rock on. That's badass. But if you want more, if you want a relationship with your creator that deepens, that is so enriched that you can look at things from a different perspective. If you want something where you wake up one day and realize that the things that you say and do in helping others truly affects their life, that in some cases you can save or alter the course of their life. Now, this is heady stuff for a train wreck like me. This is heady stuff. But recovery guarantees that I can do that. And so all we're asking is that perhaps we kind of circle back around, do what we can to clear up some of the confusion over here and get some clarity as it sifts through this common solution that the book talks about, which is pretty, pretty groovy. Thank you guys. I love y'all. And I'm hoping like a big dog, y'all get a good night's sleep and then we can hit it in the morning and do some stuff. Thank y'all.